Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. New York Times bestselling author Tana French is a writer who creates great excitement with the publication of each of her crime novels. Her eighth novel and second standalone, The Searcher, has already become a standout and a critic favorite. Her first novel to feature an American protagonist and to be told in the third person, The Searcher brings all of Tana French's powerhouse atmospherics and characterization to a story that plays with the traditions of suspense fiction, but does not fail to keep readers guessing. It's why the New York Times proclaimed she is in a class by herself. Tana French is the author of seven previous novels, including In the Woods, The Likeness, and The Witch Elm. Her novels have sold over 3 million copies, have won numerous awards, including the Edgar, Anthony, McCavity, and Barry Awards, and of course, the Irish Book Award for Crime Fiction. It is a great pleasure to welcome Tana French to this week's book show. What a delight to have you on the program. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on, Joe. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. At what point did you start to think about a standalone again and to get away from the series and to say, this is something that I want to do, and I want to do something a little bit different?
I've been reading a lot of Westerns around the time I started kind of bouncing around ideas for a new book. And I was thinking that their settings have a lot of resonances with the West of Ireland. Like, there's that harsh country that demands like real physical and mental toughness from anyone who lives there. And there's also that sense of a place that both culturally and geographically is really distant from the centers of power. So there's this feeling that the power brokers don't know or care about people's lives, and anyone living there, they're going to have to set their own rules, and they're going to have to set, you know, enforce those rules themselves if they want a functioning society. So I was thinking, what would it be like to take some of the Western tropes and transpose them to the West of Ireland? So that already was a whole different place. Like, I've always written about Dublin before, the West. I've loved the West, but never written about it. And also, I started thinking about the stranger in town. You know how he rolls into the Westerns and strolls into the saloon, and maybe he's got a few secrets. And he's a disruptor. He's a catalyst. You know things are going to change around him. So I thought, I wanted that stranger, but Ireland being Ireland, he couldn't be Irish, because he would have some connection with that village, even if he came from all the way across the country and had never been there before. Everyone knows everyone. Or if they don't know you, they know your auntie and they'll find out. So in order to be like a proper outsider who would disrupt the established order in that way, he had to be from another country. So there I was with an American narrator for the first time. I've always written Irish narrators. And also, if you're playing with Westerns, you're talking about people who are about action. They're not about thoughts and interior life. And I'd always written first person, because I'd always written narrators where the action was very much about what was going on inside their minds. Whereas Cal, my narrator here, it's his actions that matter to him. He doesn't consider thoughts to be the most important thing. So it wound up being third person. So yeah, I wound up with a novel that was very different from what I'd done before.
Cal is fascinating. He is a former Chicago police officer. He is coming out of a marriage, and he comes to Ireland. And just that choice is to say, I want to get away from what I had. And yet he's very conscious of that he made that decision to leave, and he doesn't really want to go back to any aspect that was similar to the life he had.
Yeah, he doesn't want to, but you know, in anything that has to do with Western tropes, that old gunslinger, he's always right. Going to get dragged out of retirement for one more mission, you know? And that's what happens to Cal. This local kid starts hanging around and bugging him to investigate what happened to his 19-year-old brother who's gone missing. And Cal doesn't want to do it, but he feels like this kid has no one else. The police don't care. The village doesn't care. He's got nobody. So Cal has to dust off his metaphorical cowboy hat and go looking.
Is there something in reading the Westerns of the moral ambiguity of the characters that drew you in, that fascinated you?
Yes, yes, absolutely. That's one of the things that caught me. Westerns are so involved with the idea of morality. And I think a lot of us have been thinking of morality these days, and there's such an urge to make it simple, to go, all right, this person liked a really vile comment on Twitter, so they must be evil, end of story. Or else, you know, conversely, this person regularly does terrible things to people, but they say they're religious, so they must be a good person. End of story. And what I like about Westerns is they're so matter of fact about the complexity of morality. They're full of people who are trying to do the right thing in situations where that's not even an option, or there's mostly good people who sometimes do bad things and vice versa. And there's the fact that people of every kind can find it very hard to cope with this. And Westerns don't try to gloss over that complexity. They don't try to like deny it or explain it away. They just lay it out. And that ended up being central to Cal's character. What with the ending of his marriage and the ending of his career, he's been left feeling like somehow along the way he lost touch with his moral code. And he cares about that. He's always tried to be a good man, and he's no longer sure that he counts as one. So he's believed that the distinction between right and wrong is it's straightforward. You treat people right, you get stuff done, you're basically okay. But it's become more complicated than that somehow. So he reckons if he can get thousands of miles away from any of these complications to this little village where he's not a detective, he's not a father or a husband anymore, maybe right and wrong will seem simple again. But it doesn't turn out to be that easy, of course.
You also have him just questioning his career choice and putting him at a time as a police officer who is in a city where there are issues of systemic racism and police violence that are swirling. You put him in that. He talks about it and we obviously find out more, but it is central to the part of the job that led him away from it.
Yes, it is, because one of the things that interests me about detectives and police officers is the huge variety of reasons why people go into this. And for Cal, I mean, he needed a steady job, but there was also the fact that he likes to fix things. And he felt that this was a job in which he could fix things, keep people safe, make things safer, make things fixed. And he's been forced to confront the fact that it really doesn't necessarily work that way out there in the real world. And that this thing that's so important to him, being a good man, may not be like the line he has is it's become clear to him that one or the other of them, him or the job, can't be trusted. And he doesn't know if it's that he's lost hold of his moral code and is no longer capable of distinguishing right and wrong, or whether it's that being a police officer means that you are part of something that is so intricately messed up that sometimes there isn't a right. There is nothing you can do to fix things. There is no action you can take that would make a situation okay. And to him, that's a deep shock to his system. And that's what one of the things he's trying to get away from.
Tana French's new novel is The Searcher. It is published by Viking. Let us talk about Trey, who is the young man that comes into Cal's life and really starts to mix things up, but it's an interesting relationship between the two.
Yeah, I mean, they start out on the surface. It's that Trey wants someone who's going to find out what happened to his brother, and he's got nowhere else to turn. And Cal, who used to be a detective, seems like the perfect person to do this. And Cal is only involved in this because he can't abandon the kid, and because also he wants to be left alone, and the kid's clearly not going to do that. But they also, there are, whether they would acknowledge it or not, other things they need from each other. Trey, his dad has gone off somewhere, nobody's quite sure where. He's 13. He needs someone or something that will show him how to grow up, how to mature, how to be who he wants to turn into. And he ends up looking for that in Cal. And Cal, meanwhile, has a kind of fractured, distant relationship with his grown-up daughter. He's not sure quite where things went wrong, and he's not sure whether he did something wrong, whether he could have done things better. And he's looking for a place to feel like he's doing the right thing and fixing things. And again, it doesn't turn out to be quite that simple, but they are looking for something in each other. And it goes back to the Western tropes. There's always people in Westerns who find each other accidentally while they're searching for something else and end up shifting the course of each other's journey.
Would you ever think of writing a straight out Western?
See, I like messing with genres. I don't like straight up genre. I like seeing what happens when you use them as a starting point, and then you play with them, and then you take them and put them somewhere else, and then you mix them up with a little of something else. I like taking genre boundaries as, starting points.
Which is exactly what you did with the mystery genre, that is, or crime fiction. That's exactly what you did in that genre.
Well, that's what I like doing. And I think I came along at a good point because I was reading stuff like Mystic River, and Dennis Lehane with that just absolutely refused to recognize any of the genre boundaries as limitation. He was like, I can write a great mystery with beautiful writing, and it's a social history, and it's a family saga, and it's going to be all of that thrown into one. And there you go. So I came along just kind of after all of that generation who were doing this glorious explosion of the boundary. So it was a good place to start writing because there really was a lot of scope to go, okay, we get to redefine where mystery can go, and we get to not just stick to its conventions. We get to play with them and keep the ones we want and mix in a little bit of something else if we feel like it. Yeah, I love doing that.
So let's talk about something you mentioned a moment ago about the difference between writing in the first person versus the third person. I mean, in the first person, as you said, there's that time where we have such access to the characters, and we know what they're thinking. We're inside their heads. We know their feelings. We know their thoughts. And yet, this is as psychological as any of your books, and yet we have it at a distance because Cal isn't a guy who believes in introspection.
Yeah, it is. It's definitely a shift because I think for me, it was more natural to write first person because I'm coming from an acting background. So it's very natural to see the whole world of the story through one character's eyes and their biases, their fears, their needs, and shape everything through that because that's how you see stuff as an actor. The world of the play exists through that one character's eyes for you. But third person, it not only tells you something about the character and himself, but it also allows for very different ways of communicating him to the reader. Because instead of going into detail about Cal's thoughts and feelings, which you kind of need to do to an extent if you're in first person, because otherwise, what's first person for? In this book, I got to show it through his actions a lot more and let the reader infer from what he does what he must be or might be feeling. It allows him to be slightly more mysterious to the reader in certain points, if you want, if that's the way the book needs to go. And it allows it for the reader to infer things more than being told them, which I thought was really interesting. I like doing that.
Was it ever a challenge in the sense, or was it always a challenge? I mean, did you have to sort of relearn it, or once you got it, you got it?
Came quite naturally, I think, because it came from the character himself.
Mm.
You're interacting with the book through the lens of the character, and that's what worked best for him. I think it would have felt really weird and wrong to try to write him in the first person.
I thought it was interesting when you were talking at the beginning of our conversation about Westerns and using the Western as a guide. And we always, of course, think of the Western United States, and you were thinking about the west of Ireland, and that in and of itself is interesting. Talk a little bit about the difference, since you have written so much about Dublin, to then go to the western coast of Ireland, and those differences that were so palpable.
Well, first of all, you've got just the scenery. I've loved the west of Ireland since I was a teenager, but it's very different from the east, which is where I live. The east, it's much gentler, much lusher landscape. The weather is much more gentle. Whereas out the west, you've got much wilder, harsher landscape, and you've got Atlantic winds, Atlantic waves, trees that are bent at a permanent angle from this wind coming straight in off thousands of miles of ocean. It's a whole different feeling. You're much more in the west. Nature is this thing that it's going to do its own thing. You can't necessarily shelter from it, you can't force it to do anything. You just have to live with it on its own terms. But there's also the other interesting thing was the fact of writing about a rural community rather than a city. And the big difference for me was that in a city, right, you have the option of not having much effect on your neighbors. If you keep to yourself and you don't play your music too loud, you can basically not have any impact on them at all. But if you live in a small rural community, that isn't really an option. You naturally, inevitably, your actions have an impact on the community around you. Like Lena, one of the other characters, points out to Cal at one point that when loads of young women from the townland started leaving for the cities for better jobs, the young men who were inheriting the farms had no one to marry. So you've got a load of old bachelors getting older on their farms, and that changes the entire dynamic of the place. It shifts the tone of the village. So what seems like an individual decision, I'm going to go to the city and get a job there, turns out not, in fact, to be just your decision. It turns out to have an impact on your entire community. And I thought that was something that really needed highlighting and shouldn't be dismissed, one of the core things about living somewhere rural.
One of the things, when it comes to the rural character, that was fascinating to me in reading about Cal is that he's a newcomer. He's been there for just a few months, year and a half, and yet he's still, there is the geography where someone will mention the Gannon's house or the McConnell's house, and he knows that basic geography, but yet there's still a lot to learn of the dynamics of who those people are and how they relate to one another.
Yes, I don't think he really realizes that till well into the book, because he spends a lot of time out walking, just walking around for hours on end, familiarizing himself with that geography because he wants to know the place that he's chosen for his home. But I think he has an idea of it that is very much an outsider's idea, that a small place will be simple. It will be easy to get to know. It will be straightforward. And he wants simplicity at that point. He wants a place where things are quite clear. But what he has overlooked is the fact that in a place like that, that's actually where the bonds between people, the network of relationships, are most intricate and most complex, because they go back for generations. You know, there are people who won't speak to each other because of a feud that their grandparents had in the 80s. Or there's an entire family who is tarred with one brush because something somebody did generations ago. Nobody exists purely as themselves in a community that's been together for so long. And he's forced to start understanding some of those dynamics and some of that history as he gets drawn into it, and forced to accept that if he's going to get involved with this, he's not just getting involved with one question, where is Brendan Reddy? He's getting involved with this entire network. And you, like a spider web, you touch one thread, it shakes the whole thing.
As you said a few moments ago, I mean, he wants to do the right thing, but there is definitely a development of his moral compass.
I think so, yeah. I think he comes to accept that idea that there are situations where there may not be a right thing to do, and there are situations where doing a right thing may not be enough. It may not fix anything. But what he comes to isn't necessarily the idea that, oh, well, then forget it, I'm just going to not try to do anything at all. It's that sometimes all you can do is your best. You can get as close as possible to right and accept that it may not be perfect, but you still have to keep doing it. You still have to keep trying and winging it to a large extent. Sometimes you do your best on the fly.
Your background is so fascinating. You have both dual American and Italian citizenship. You were born in Vermont, and you have the accent that you have. So,
whatever that is, yeah, I know.
So, give us a sense of what drew you to Ireland in the first place, of going to college there, and to live there now, to stay there.
Well, we've been coming back here for summers since I was a kid, and I really loved it here. I loved the place. I loved the emphasis on talk and on humor. Just the fact that people will spend hours just chatting and messing and having a laugh, and the emphasis on connection. And I just really liked it. I liked it a lot. Also, I was coming from Rome at that stage, and the contrasts between Rome and Ireland really kind of highlighted Ireland well, like the emphasis on friendship. In Rome, if you're a teenager, a lot of the emphasis was on, there was an idea that guys and girls couldn't really be friends. They were either going out together or they didn't have any relationship at all. And I love the fact that coming back here to Ireland, I had loads of guy friends. I had girlfriends, I had guy friends. people could do that. This emphasis on friendship was a big thing to me. I've always valued friendship really highly. I liked that. I liked the feel of it. It just seemed like a good place to go. And one of the things about having moved around a lot, like I have, and coming from having a whole bunch of nationalities and a whole bunch of origins, is that anywhere seems like a possibility. When you leave school, there was no particular reason why I should go to one place over any other. It was just, where do you like? Where do you feel at home? I had friends here. I'd been coming here for summers. Sure, where else would I go? So 1990, I finished school, came here, and I've been here ever since.
Not entirely sure that I know what this means, but do you consider yourself an Irish writer?
Ha! That is an interesting one, and I don't really know if there's an answer. Like, okay, I'm entitled to Irish citizenship, but need to get organized and sorted out. But I'm not Irish in the way that, my husband is Irish, where he is Dublin to the core for as many generations back, probably, as the city itself has existed. And I know I'm never going to be Irish in that particular way, but I'm more Irish than I am anything else. Like, this is the only city where I feel like I have any right to call it home. It's the only city where I know my way around and, know all the little nuances that make a city what it is. And as a writer, I think, yeah, definitely I'm an Irish writer. I'm an Irish writer in an odd way, in that I have that slight half outsider's eye where you don't take the cultural conventions for granted the way someone who grew up with them might. You're always noticing them and noticing how they contrast to other places you've been. Again, Irish writer, because I'm writing about Ireland, it's home, but Irish writer with that slightly skewed perspective.
And there's such a beautiful tradition of Irish literature that you are now a part of. How much of that has been on your radar? I'm assuming going to Trinity quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, even with this book, this definitely, it's got Western riffs in there, but it's got a lot of Irish literature riffs in there as well. Like The Stranger in Town, he's a big thing in Irish literature as well. Like if you look at Playboy of the Western World, which is one of the great classics of Irish drama, that's all about a stranger who on the run who comes into a small Irish town and how he shakes up the established order there. But also the idea of the outsider in society and the fraught relationship between them, like a society which is so far from the centers of power that it's become its own mini society, its own with its own laws, and what happens when the representative of outside authority comes into that runs through Irish literature as well, with the John B. Keane play The Field, which was made into a film there with Richard Harris a while back. So there's a lot of themes out of Irish literature show up in what I'm doing as well. And I think it's yeah, I'm a hybrid writer maybe, but I went to Trinity, studied Irish literature. It's going to come out. Yeah, it's going
Right.
to show up in here as well.
What is it like now? I was last in Dublin just before the COVID outbreak, and I can't imagine that city, well, even the country, but especially that city shut down, although I couldn't, I can't imagine New York either, which is so close to us. So what has it been like to have the country in virtual lockdown and to be alone, especially in a country that so reveres getting together?
Yeah, it's been strange. It's been really strange. I mean, I saw a photo during the serious lockdown of, I don't know if you know, Halfpenny Bridge, which is right in
Oh,
the
sure.
heart of Dublin. Most Saturday nights, it'd be like people pouring out of pubs and chatting and taxis going back and forth and night buses. And there was a photo of it one Saturday night, empty except for a fox standing on the steps of the Halfpenny Bridge, right in the center of town. It was really strange and eerie. Now, for me, I haven't been alone because I've been in lockdown with my husband and kids, and they're my favorite people in the world. So mostly it's been good, but solitude hasn't been one of my major problems the last while, we'll put it like that. It's been weird, you're right, because this is a society that's built on everybody getting together and talking and having a crack and just large groups having banter and often in pubs. So there's been a real strangeness about it, but I think people are really creative. People always find ways, whether it's Zoom calls or a bunch of kind of teenagers in our neighborhood ended up having socially distanced cocktails in a laneway where they all sat 2 meters apart and had a laugh. And they really did it. They really did socially distance, but they were still managing to get together for a laugh and a drink.
You're talking about the Haypenny Bridge. There's a beautiful bookstore there, The Winding Stair. I think of that being of that whole area, and of course the pubs being shut down. My thought is of how it affects you as an artist, how it affects you as a writer. Of what impact do you think it will, or is it having on writing the next novel?
Oof, well, I mean, I got lucky and handed in this one, I think, 12 days before the schools shut down and everything just went poof. So my timing was good on that one. I was only doing edits and copy edits and proofread rather than having to come up with something from scratch. But it hasn't been easy. Like by now I should be getting stuck into the next book. But while I've got an idea, I'm realizing how much you rely on your subconscious to process that idea into something that you can actually turn into a book. And like everybody else on the planet, I don't really have much of a subconscious right now. All my bandwidth is being used up by processing what's going on and trying to understand at some level the incomprehensible and just deal with things on a day-to-day basis. What I'm interested to see is what kind of literature comes out of this sort of 5 or 10 years down the line when people have had time to process what have been the strange, unexpected positive angles, what's been the fallout society-wise, what on earth has this done to our brains? I'm interested in seeing what happens when people have had time to process that on a literary level.
Well, the new novel is The Searcher. It is absolutely perfect, just a beautiful, beautiful read. It is published by Viking. Tana French, what a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Joe, thank you so much for having me on. It's a joy as always, and I really appreciate it.
Great pleasure. Thank you. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.